All right, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Shieldcocks Happens, sponsored by Prospect Bomb and the Dustin Shieldcocks Foundation. A lot of good stories, a lot of good news, so stay tuned, plug in, and enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Shieldcocks Happens podcast. My name is Dustin Shieldcocks, and with me always, Jameson Brown.
Hey, everybody. How you guys doing? Glad you guys are tuning in for another episode. It's a fun ride, and we're glad to have everyone listening. And today we are lucky enough to have a discussion with Brent Brown, who I'm also lucky enough to call my dad, about the struggles and the successes of being a business owner through good and bad times. And with that, Dad, feel free to introduce yourself and
Great.
Go from there.
Well, it's good to be here this morning. Like Jamie said, I'm Brent Brown, the owner of Brent Brown Toyota in Orem. And yeah, it started off, I was the lead singer and lead guitar player in a professional rock band. We actually opened for ZZ Top and did a record and, right. You know, the whole nine yards.
Yeah, that's guitar collection.
And, that is sick.
Anyway, that was my whole youth. I started playing guitar when I was 6 years old and spent my whole youth thinking that I was going to be a rock star. And anyway, got to the point where we were knocking on the door, but we were playing big concerts all over and touring all over. And like I said, did a record, opened for some big bands. ZZ Top was probably the biggest one of the bunch. But learned a really interesting lesson from the ZZ Top concert. The next morning in the Salt Lake Tribune, they did an article, just a review of the concert and all that stuff. I still have a copy of it because it was one of those kind of life moments. And they said, after they talked all this, all this stuff about ZZ Top and how good of a job they did, and then they said Roadwork, a local band, opened the show, and they said, not bad, but not distinctive, unless you enjoy watching Brent Brown play the guitar with his teeth. And it was one of my trademarks. I'd play the guitar. I did the little Jimi Hendrix thing, and played the guitar with my teeth and behind my back and all that stuff.
Mind you, he still does a lot of that.
Right. At the time, I was 17 years old, and I didn't know what the word distinctive even meant. I really honestly wasn't familiar with it. And I remember, looking it up because I was like, what are they saying here? And I really wanted, what does everybody think after the big show? And when I figured out what it meant, it was really like just a 2x4 up at the side of the head, And it changed me for the rest of my life because when I realized that distinctive really was saying that you had to stand out from the crowd to be distinctive. You had to be different than everybody else. And I think what they were saying is, this was a pretty good band. I mean, they did a pretty good job. But they weren't really distinctive other than some guy that played the guitar with his teeth. I've thought about it ever since, for the rest of my life. I mean, that happened 40 years ago. That's crazy sitting and think about it now. I'm 57 years old.
40 years ago.
That was 40 years ago that event took place. But I think about that distinctive part all the time and the fact that if you're going to do anything in business or anything in life or anything that you would want to be successful at, first and foremost, it's got to be distinctive. Otherwise, you're just another, mixed into the crowd player kind of thing. So anyway, that event, that experience has driven my life pretty hard. In almost everything that I've done, I've been trying to find, okay, here's the given profession that I'm in, or even when it was back in my a little bit later youth, when I decided to serve an LDS mission in England, and I was trying to think, okay, how can I stand out? How can I be distinctive? How can I do it differently? And then as I became a car salesperson, same thing, trying to figure out, okay, there's a gazillion car salespeople out there all selling cars, and how can I do it differently so that people will remember me and want to come back? And it's kind of driven my life.
The question I have is, how long have you, for people who are going to be tuning in, how long have you been in the auto industry? I mean, how long have you been around it?
Well, first off, I was in real estate for a little bit, and then moved to Texas and was planning on going into real estate. And Texas wouldn't honor the real estate license that I had from Utah, and I had to be there for 2 months until I could apply.
Now, was this in the 80s?
Yeah, this would have been 1984.
Okay.
And so I thought, well, I don't really have enough money saved to be able to go 2 months without working. So I tried construction for like a week or 10 days and thought I was going to die.
Wasn't your style?
In the middle. Well, it was not just the style. It was like the middle of the summer in Texas, and it was just brutal hot.
Yeah.
And I figured I'd by very much too much longer, I'd be dead. So anyway, so I responded. I actually was looking for a job to sell musical instruments at a music store, and none of them had any openings. So there was an ad to sell cars at a Volkswagen dealership, and that's when I responded to that. So on August the 3rd of 1984, I started working at this place. It was called Bob Miller Volkswagen in Austin, Texas. And it took me until the 16th of August to sell my first car. And it spooked me because...
What is it like from that standpoint? Because, you know, a lot of people go through that where it's like, you're not bringing a check home for a week. You're not bringing a check home for 2 weeks. And you literally just started a new gig. What's that? What type of stress does that put on you, your family, and I mean, people that you're around, your demeanor? What did that do to you?
It was an enormous stress. I remember being at a point where I had a quarter of a tank of gas in our car, and $1.64 left, and I was thinking, man, if something doesn't happen soon, I'm in trouble. And it's really, really funny, but my first sales manager at that Volkswagen dealership forgot to tell me. You're going to die laughing at this, but he forgot to tell me that there was a $1,500 a month guarantee.
He forgets to tell you.
He hired me and put me on the floor, and I didn't know that. And, you know, I've thought back many times, thank goodness I didn't know that, because I was working so hard. But it's interesting, I've thought back on it so much of what I was doing during that first 2 weeks when I never sold anything. And again, I was scared. My boss was scared. He wasn't sure. He thought maybe he'd hired the wrong guy, you know, all that stuff. And I was questioning whether I had the ability. But during that whole 2 weeks, I was just crunching on getting all of my product knowledge down and taking down the phone numbers and information on every single person I would talk to or that would call in, and I'd follow up with them. And I was looking back at it now, I was doing everything that you should do. The only thing is I wasn't selling any cars.
And then, moments like that, though, like a blessing in disguise.
And again, because of not knowing that I had a $1,500 paycheck, I was just all over it. I mean, really, really working hard. And I think had I known that that $1,500 cushion was there, because in 1984, $1,500 was a decent amount of money. You know, it's not like you're going to get rich off it, but I think if I had known it was there, I maybe would have backed off the throttle a little. You know what I mean? Just,
for sure.
Just human nature. Well, anyway, so finally on August 16th, I sold my first car. It was a Volkswagen Rabbit, of all things, to a guy named Phil Kasparik. I still remember his name. And he came in, and that one broke the ice, and that was my first car. And I ended that August having sold 17 cars, and I was the dealership's top salesperson. And they paid me a pretty good check. Well, the next month, and see, I was only going to do this for 2 months.
So that's what I was going to,
In the last 15 days, though, so you sold your first car August 16th, and then you sold the rest of those in the last...
More than a car a day for the next, you know, the second half of the month.
So obviously you started off and...
Yeah, and they paid me a paycheck of $3,950, and I remember thinking I had just... like broken the bank, man. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this happened. But I thought, well, I'm going to do it for another month until I can get my real estate license. And so then I did it the next month, and the next month I broke the dealership's all-time record that had stood for, like, I don't know, a lot of years. And they paid me even more, and I thought, man, this is unbelievable. And
did you say this was a career?
It was a few months later, because I was kind of rationalizing and justifying it there at first. Because, okay, so after I broke the all-time record, and so now that's 2 months, and so now it's time to get the real estate license, I was thinking, man, maybe I should do this for just two more months. And so I thought, I'll go 2 more months. Well, the next 2 months, I broke the dealership's all-time record again, so broke my own record each month of those months. And so after 4 months of this, I get a phone call from the local BMW dealership. And they said, we understand you can sell German cars pretty well. If you'll come over, we'll give you a BMW to drive as a company car. And I'm like, whoa, I'm like, you got to be kidding, you know, because I was thinking driving a BMW would be the coolest thing in the world.
How old are you at this point?
And at this point, I'm 25.
And you have a wife and kid and everything?
Yeah, I had at that point I had a wife and Jameson, and my wife was pregnant with his younger brother.
Okay.
When the BMW dealership called with that, I thought, man, I got to do this. So I went over there and was there 2.5 months and did real well, made even more than I had been making at the Volkswagen dealership. And then lo and behold, the Volkswagen dealership calls me up and says, we just got the Jaguar franchise. And if you'll come back, we'll give you a Jaguar company car and we'll pay all your gas. And I'm like, man, this is crazy. And it was probably around that point that I thought, maybe I should do this. But that was when I faced my first real challenge. See, because up until then, I had, you know, not to sound arrogant, but I had kind of mowed over everybody in my path at that point and had really amazing success. Mm-hmm. So I get to the new Jaguar, you know, department of the dealership that I had been working at before, and they had hired a guy from England that was about 6'4", a bodybuilder kind of guy, really athletic and really eloquent speaking. And I mean, he was everybody's perfect impression of a Jaguar salesperson. I mean, he knew how to say Jaguar just right, you know. And I mean, great salesperson. I remember thinking, whew, this is going to be tough. Then I find out that he's basically got the next 3 months of product all sold, pre-sold.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be tough. And I thought, you know, the only thing I've got left to sell is used cars. And so I got real good at selling used cars, but the other thing I got real good at is getting deposits as backups on all of his, so that if anybody would even flinch, one of his customers, I immediately had it sold. So on the third month, I beat him, and then I beat him 16 months in a row. I was their top salesperson for 16 straight months. And until they then made me a manager, and then I ended up getting a phone call from my the guy who had been my mission president, asking me to come to Utah, and open what was his newly acquired Suzuki franchise. So by that time I was 27 years old, and that was my first shot at running a dealership. And I thought, okay, how do I do something really different? And what's different about this thing? Because really, if you look at it, it's just a little tinny box made by Suzuki that looks like a miniature Jeep. And I got to figure out how to make this work. And I decided that the best approach would be to say that we were selling fun, not just cars. I mean, we were going to make your life fun and add some spark to it kind of thing. And so we did all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, I brought in an old car that got traded in. I gave all my salespeople sledgehammers and had them go out and beat the heck out of it, just absolutely wipe out this car, and then had it all photographed while they were doing it. And then put newspaper ads in with this car, our guys beating up this car and saying, we get the dull out of your life, you know, and we'll get rid of this dull car of yours and get you into something fun, you know. And then we had like a big contest that made national news of people putting their hand on the car, and whoever was on at the end won the car. And, you know, anyway, we did all this stuff. We had another contest of, you know, who could do the craziest thing to win a Suzuki. And man, you wouldn't believe the stuff that people did. At that time, it was really just one product for the most part. And we were just trying to sell the fact that this was fun. And if you bought one of these, your life would be more, you know, have more pizzazz to it, and you'd have more fun. So that's kind of the approach we took. Well, the good news is that we opened for business on April 15th, tax day, of 1986, and we ended 1986 eighth in the nation. In other words, for the 8.5 months that we were in business that year, we were number one in the nation, six of them. And so it was a big success. It kind of launched my career forward. And then my competitor called and asked if I would come to work there, which I did, and ended up subsequently becoming the manager of all of his dealerships. And
who was the competitor?
Stephen White. Still one of my dearest friends, lifelong friend, and he's a big auto dealer down in St. George, Utah. So there were these periods of kind of having real good success and then taking on a challenge and then having success and so on and so forth. And then when I got the offer like 5 years later to come back to the company that had the Suzuki dealership originally, it was called Rick Warner at that time. and to come back and open up their newly acquired Toyota and Honda dealerships in Orem, Utah. And that one was probably the biggest challenge that I had ever taken on, and maybe the biggest I've ever taken on. Let me put it in perspective. The Toyota dealership, shortly after I went in, I got a letter from Toyota, not a very nice letter, saying that we were in the bottom 20 in the whole United States. Not the bottom 20%, in the bottom 20 out of 1,200 and something dealers in customer satisfaction, that we were that bad.
And that's when you first moved? Because up until then, it sounds like from basically August 16th of 1984, I mean, it sounds like you've actually had a pretty much record-breaking
I had a really good run, and it got me moved forward in my career real early. I mean, when you consider that it was, let's see, 1992 that I opened up Rick Warner Toyota and Honda, and so let's see, if I was born in 59, so that's 33 years old at that point. And then I got also a letter from Honda letting me know that the Honda dealership was literally the last place in the country in customer satisfaction. So that's what I took over, and that was my starting point.
Here's your pile of crap.
Yeah, exactly.
Deal with it.
Exactly.
Wow.
And I remember walking in, and most of the salespeople were all smoking cigarettes, wearing sunglasses inside the dealership with their feet up on their desks reading the paper. I mean, you hear jokes about that stuff, but that's literally what I walked in and saw. And I mean, customers upset everywhere, and just the absolute worst customer treatment you can imagine. And I thought, okay, well, there's nowhere to go but up. And then the thing that I think really, really launched my career with Toyota, especially, was the fact that I, a year and a half later, got the dealership to the point that it won Toyota's President's Award, which is the highest award they give for a well-run, customer-focused dealership.
Now, what decisions did you have to make to get to that point, though?
I mean, man, it was
what'd you have to do?
So many things related to everything from you know, upgrading and beautifying the facility to, you know, to getting salespeople trained and getting you know, the customer satisfaction scores at a certain level and getting profitability to a certain level and all these indices that they had that you had to get the dealership to be able to win the award. And anyway, it did a lot for my career when subsequently years later in 1997, when the company that owned the dealerships that I managed announced a merger with another one of the big auto dealer groups here in Utah. And basically at that point, I was either going to be just a really teeny tiny percentage owner of a whole bunch of dealerships or the owner of the Toyota dealership. And there was a dispute over whether or not I had the right to buy the Toyota dealership or not. And we battled that out for a year and a half. Then finally, at the end of the year and a half, I finally got the Toyota dealership.
What was your thought process through that year and a half?
Yeah, that was an interesting one because, to be honest, every day that I came to work during that year and a half, I wasn't sure if that was the day I was going to get fired or if that was the day I was going to become the owner of the dealership, because it was all based on a right of first refusal that I had. And I felt like I had a right of first refusal that would allow me to purchase the dealership. And the people that owned it didn't feel like I had that right. And so we were battling over that. And they would really like to have gotten me out of the way, to be quite frank, so that they could go forward and do this merger without me.
For sure. So in what year did you actually, I guess...
1999.
That's when you bought your first dealership.
So August of 1999 was when it finally closed. And on August 9th of 1999, I finally became the owner and then went from there.
And where'd you go from there?
From there, about a year later, built a new Toyota facility down in Provo, moved it down there, then ended up buying my neighboring dealerships, a Chevrolet Buick and a Dodge Chrysler Jeep dealership. Actually, it was a Dodge dealership, and then I bought a Chrysler Jeep dealership and moved it in with Dodge and, you know, all this stuff, and ended up with 10 franchises. And
so you had all these dealerships, and you had different groups managing different stores,
right,
and all that stuff and making sure things were going well. At what point did you think, yeah, you know, this – I'm on the high road, and at what point did
I've got
that
a good answer
change?
For that, because The answer is just before the recession, I thought, hey, I'm on the high road, it's all going good, and then bam, it's like
recession.
It's when, like, was that? When was actually when the recession started?
2008. Let me put it in perspective. So we were riding pretty high. At the time, we were the third largest auto dealer group in Utah. There was Larry Miller and Ken Garf and then us. And man, things were going really well. We were selling a bunch of cars and very successful. And then all of a sudden, the recession hit. The Toyota dealership in May of 2008 had its biggest month that it ever had and sold 353 cars. In November of that same year, 2008, so we're really only talking about June, July, August, September, October, November. 6 months later, 155 cars. A 200 car drop, because in September, the month before, Lehman Brothers had hit the wall and the recession just bam. I mean, it just wiped out our business, and it took us several months to even get to the point where we could sell 200 cars. And at that point, my dealership group, instead of making a bunch of money, was just losing all kinds of money, and it was really an ugly thing, trying to stay on top of it, but then also trying to make decisions from a long-term standpoint, like, for instance, my employees with a matching 401k plan. I ended up being the only big dealer in Utah that maintained that through the recession. Everybody else bailed, and I kept matching people on 401k because I just kept feeling like, you know, when this recession finally is over, I want to be able to have a bond with my employees that will last for a whole lot longer and take me into, you know, retirement.
As you're going through all this, I mean, obviously the recession hits, you have to make some sacrifices at work. And then, like, what about your life at home? Like, how has that changed with family? I mean, what's going on in all those areas as well?
Did you have to sell stuff?
Yeah, one of the biggest sacrifices. I know this is going to sound really petty and really stupid, but I think everybody has, you know, whether it's somebody that collects little silver spoons or whether they collect baseball cards or comic books or who knows, but our society, human nature is that you kind of have a little passion for something and you know, it's something that you really, it means a lot to you. Well, for me, it was more than just a little passion. It was a pretty expensive one, but going back to my days from when I was a professional guitar player, there were several guitars that from back of that, in that era or a little before, mostly made around the time that I was born, that had become extremely valuable. We're talking like hundreds of thousands of dollars each valuable. And I had put together one of the better collections in the country of what they would call vintage guitars. Just one of my guitars, for instance, sold at Christie's auction for over $300,000. And that was just one of them. And I had, 35 guitars in this collection. It was an amazing collection. And I remember the day when I said, you know, I can't run the risk of not being able to make payroll for my people and do all the things that I need to do to keep them safely employed and all that. And I remember picking up the phone and selling half of my guitar collection. I said, okay, I'm going to sell off half of it and I'll keep the other half. It's interesting. I couldn't bring myself to sell all of it. But it's also interesting to note that years later, this is 2.5 years ago or so, I walked down into my basement where I have these safes that held all these guitars, and I opened them up and I saw all these guitars in there, and I said to myself, you know what? I'm the only one that really gets any enjoyment out of this. And I open up these safes and I look in there and I kind of pound my chest and I go, I'm the king of Bunker Hill kind of thing. And I pull them out and I'll play them and so on and so forth. And then I put them back in the safe and that's pretty much that. And I thought, you know, I could do something that would be so much more enjoyable for family, for dealership employees, for friends and neighbors, and so on and so forth. So I sold the other half of them and built a house in Cabo San Lucas. So yeah, now I don't have the collection of guitars, but I think I accomplished some more important things. I kept my company safe to where it could then, after the recession, turn into what it is today. It's been there has been a real focus on my part of trying to get a group of people together and then, in essence, protect them by giving them a great place to work, you know, a good job, so on and so forth. And then in return, by doing that, they would give me my freedom. It's kind of this give and take thing that I saw in my mind many years ago, and it has come really, really true. Now, most of my management staff has been with me for 10 to 25 years, and we just have, it's an unusual dealership where, you know, not only is it the number one volume new car dealership in Utah, we're also the number one in the whole six-state region in customer retention. Anyway, we felt really, really proud about that, to be able to now take that, and then, for instance, the readers of Utah Valley Magazine voted us their favorite new car dealer now for 3 years in a row.
Going for number four.
And we've won the Toyota President's Award 8 times now, you know, and it's like, there's a lot of really, really good things that have happened, and I think I can honestly say that none of it happened just by chance. You know, I mean, there was a lot of hard work involved and a lot of, like, trying to think it through of how would this turn into this and how would that turn into that, and little by little we made it.
One of the questions I have, and I think you and I have talked about it a few times, but it's always one of those, I know a lot of people haven't heard this. What point in time during, let's call it for what it is, 2008 to now, did you think about folding up shop? Because I know that there are a lot of other competitors around, whether it was auto, whether it was other industry, whatever, but there were a lot of different businesses that were basically folding up the tent, counting their losses, and moving on. At what point did you almost think about doing
that? And especially
that?
Like when you said, I mean, the guitar is obviously that has a sentimental value to you. And that's actually, I mean, it sounds amazing just to keep pushing forward, to make sure you keep your employees and a great work environment. I mean, that's a...
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I didn't make a big thing out of that, but it was interesting that a couple of my managers really did, I found out. They went around and told people, you know, the thing that probably matters to Brent more than anything, other than maybe, you know, his kids, would be those guitars. And he just sold them so that you guys could all get paychecks. And I guess they all made a big thing out of it. And it kind of rallied my employees. It kind of got them all thinking, all right, we all need to do our part and we need to survive this and we need to do the best we can to improve and flourish during this difficult time. And, you know, so, yeah, I guess looking back on it, I'm glad I did it. But it was, you know, it wasn't just, you're not going to survive in a situation like that just by selling some assets. I mean, you've got to really, really buckle down and get smart. And every single thing you do has to be pinpoint and meaningful, and you've got to be able to just get your way through it.
Yeah, but you can't go loosey-goosey on that one.
Not at all. And in my opinion, the easy thing is to sell out. You asked about, you know, did I think about selling? Well, yeah, I very much so. I mean,
because I know that when I was here, there were a lot of people who were literally selling out. They were just... Yeah. They were calling it quits.
What time did you work here? What year?
I was here from it would have been 01. I started selling 01 and I was here till 2012.
Yeah.
So you went through the recession.
And I went through the recession. I remember we watched dealerships literally that had opened up these brand new nice facilities with I think the Mazda store, for instance, yeah, up the street. I think they changed ownership 3 times in this.
Yeah,
space.
And it hit at a difficult time because, like I mentioned, I was out buying dealerships, and each time I would spend all the money I had to get this new dealership and then leverage things and then build that one up and then buy another one and so on. And then right after I had bought these dealerships and bought and then paid off a partner that I had in some of them, so that I was the sole owner, that's when the recession hit. Couldn't have hit at a worse time for me.
Well, you said you owned 10 different dealerships, correct?
10 franchises.
Yeah, franchises. How many do you have now?
Just Toyota. And that was one of the moves that I made, which ended up being one of the best things I ever did, was made the decision that I should sell the other dealerships, which were all domestic brands, Chevrolet, Buick, Dodge, Chrysler, Jeep, Ford, Lincoln, Mercury, domestic things. And so that's what I did was swapped the Ford dealership and the Toyota dealership in terms of location, so that then all those domestic brands were in a 21-acre auto mall that I had put together. And then I moved Toyota down to the freeway. It was a scary move because the Ford dealership that I was moving the Toyota dealership into, you know, the building that I was moving it into, that Ford dealership had had 7 different owners in the prior 8 years. It was disastrous. And a lot of people, I mean, not just a couple, but a lot of people said that the reason that that dealership was always failing and so unsuccessful was because of its location. And I was thinking, man, is this the right move? But I kept thinking to myself, if I get this Toyota dealership down onto the freeway and then get all the domestic brands into the one auto mall and then sell the auto mall and put my focus on Toyota, I think I can be successful. Interestingly enough, now that Toyota dealership outsells in new car sales, outsells all those other dealerships combined. It clobbers them, to be quite frank. And from a financial success standpoint, this Toyota dealership is now almost earning what everything earned together before.
The one thing I keep picking up, and I think it's one of the things I picked up as a kid growing up by you and kind of watching you go, the amount of times that someone told you that something couldn't be done, or the amount of times that someone told you that this is a bad decision, or this is going to fail, or this is not going to work out, you seem to come out on top. Is that a mental, is that a competitive, or is that just a gigantic, I'm going to do what I want to do. It's calculated, but I'm going to do what I want to do because I know it's going to work.
I absolutely got it from my mother. My mother was one of those, just never had a negative attitude. I mean, everything was always positive, never gave up, and never took no for an answer. And I view it as one of my most valuable possessions that I would have gained from my mother. Just this thought that there's always got to be a way to make it work. Even when everything says that there's no way, all the indicators are telling you it won't work. I just don't accept it. I just keep plowing away and trying to find a way to make it work.
That's a good way to relate to anything, really. I mean, myself, like we were talking earlier, and you as far as your struggle, I mean, I have every reason sometimes that I want to give up and I don't want to keep going forward with myself. But obviously, if you don't have that faith and the belief that you're going to overcome what your obstacle is, mine's getting out of this wheelchair. And right now, all the signs still point that it probably won't happen. But I mean, I continue to keep pushing forward and going to that next step to make it happen.
And it's a great respect I have for people like you and people like my nephews that I watched of saying, okay, I've only got this much. Of the resources I used to have, I now have this percentage of what I used to have. You have to stop, sit back, and take an assessment of what you just lost and what you still have. And then you have to look at it and say, of what I still have, what could I turn that into? If I really, really worked hard at it, what could I turn that into? And then you put all this bad stuff away and say, all right, for one, that's no longer part of my life. Two, and this is the important part, I won't let anybody make that part of my life.
Thanks, Brent. I appreciate you coming on the podcast with us. And Jameson?
Yeah, with that, another great episode. We really can't say thank you enough to Brent Brown, a.k.a. Dad, for allowing us to spend some time and kind of get his story about the trials of success and failure and where his road's been paved and how he's paved it. And so thank you again for listening and stay tuned for our next podcast. Always another great story and another great individual that we'll have. But thank you again and enjoy the rest of your day. All right, everyone. Thank you again for listening to our podcast. If you would like to be on our podcast and have a story that you want to get out there, visit us at www.dustinshieldcox.com or private message us on Facebook. And we'd love to have you on the show.